Good afternoon, everyone. I want to welcome you all to this presentation by Massey Burke. And before I introduce Massey, I thought the most important thing to do would be to just express my gratitude, all of our gratitude, for the folks who have contributed to making this project possible. So I've got a nice list here that I'm going to read, and I don't want to miss anybody's name, but this really has meant a lot to us, all the people who have been able to help us. So first things first, I need to thank the editor of Swarthmore Magazine, whose article on Massey Burke gave me the idea to invite her here to do the project. It was just that article, seeing the work that she was doing and how relative it was to the work that I was doing with students in the Container is Architecture class. So a big thank you to the Swarthmore Magazine. And then the one thing that I continue to marvel at is the Cooper Foundation, that Swarthmore College has a foundation that allows any one of us to have an idea and apply for money and be able to get that idea realized through the funding that they provide. So a great big thank you to the Cooper Foundation and that committee. And then whenever you get the funding, you have to get the job done. So there's a lot of people who have just put their hands in this thing in more ways than one to get this job done. So many thanks go to Claire Sawyers and Jeff Jabko of the Scott Arboretum, because they allowed us the space. That's the first thing. You're going to do something like this, anybody who does sculpture knows, where are you going to put it? So we were able to get a good site right outside of Beardsley. And also from the Scott Arboretum, Dwight Darko. This is a person who was always there no matter what. We would say his name and the man would just appear and get things done for us. So a special thanks for Dwight, even though he isn't here. And then in terms of just mysterious things happening, we needed some of the straw shredded, and miraculously someone appeared with a lawnmower, and then one of the groundspeople showed up with his giant lawnmower and shredded this for us, shredded it into the perfect one-inch lengths that we needed. So just whoever that mysterious lawnmower guy is, I want to just say thank you to him. And to Andrea Packard, who designed the poster that you've all been seeing around campus, and she just has attracted so much attention to this through that, so I want to thank her for doing that. And I also want to thank Mike Boyd from Facilities. He was the first person who who Massey started to have all of the conversations with about how to get this thing done. So a big thank you for that. And then, of course, to all of the students and the friends and the neighbors who came from all over the place, from long and far, from distance and from nearby. And I just want to thank you. This really, really showed just how much the visual arts is valued for our students, just to get students out there. And they came out there in the rain and the muck and in their bare feet, and they made this thing happen. And it is, I really, really want to thank you. I don't use this word ever, but I'm going to say it today. Awesome. It was just great. And then I want to say a special thank you to Kieran Fitzsimmons, who's sitting right there in the back. And she traveled from her home in California to work with Massey as her assistant on the project. And what's important about my connection with Kieran is what she's taught me. She not only taught me how to make the cob and put it on the wall to make the wall strong and beautiful, but she's one of those amazing people who have learned how to just live really close to the ground, to the earth, and to just take what she needs and no more. And that was just something so moving for me, to just meet someone who not only talks the talk, but she walks the walk. And I just want you guys to know that's an impressive woman over there. And if you get a chance, make sure you get a chance to talk to her before she leaves on Friday. And then here's something that is an absolute truth. With every project, there's has to be someone who's going to help you make it happen. No matter what you've got in place, you need someone. And that person, I mean, you can call that person, and I've got a little list of names here. That person could be your coordinator, could be your facilitator, an enabler, an ally, and lately they've been called fixers, which I like that one. But whatever you call that person, they're indispensable to your success. And in the case of our wall, that person has been Mr. Stu Hayne right there in the back. And I just wanted to express our gratitude, all of our gratitude, to how he's been able to just make things happen for the project, from materials to mobilizing his people to help us to just get something like that done. And I think that a lot of it is coming from, and I hope I'm not just putting words in his mouth, but coming from his sense of the value of having these visual symbols on campus and what they do for our community in terms of the values that we want to express. So I just want to just say thank you, Stu Hayne, for everything that you've done and continue to do for this project. And then that brings me to Massey. And this is the person, of course, who has been the voice behind this whole project. And as many of you know, Massey Burke is an alum of the college, class of 2000. She was a classics major here, in addition to doing work in the art department as a painter, and she studied with Randy Exon and Celia Reisman. And her path, leading her away from Swarthmore and then back again after 12 years, has literally taken her around the world, beginning with a year at the American School of Classical Studies in Athens, Greece, travels in India and in the Himalayas, and ultimately taking her to Northern California, where she presently makes her home in El Sobrante. And in Northern California, she studied at the Solar Living Institute, later apprenticing with Michael Smith, who's the founder of the Cobb Cottage Company, and that's the first company offering vernacular building as an alternative to conventional construction techniques in home renovation and in new construction. And she continued her practice in teaching hands-on workshops in earth building in Northern California, Washington State, Mexico, and just basically around the country, teaching people how to do this. So I just wanted to give you a little bit more of what she's been up to, because it has been a lot. Three years ago, she, along with her partner, working partner Sasha Rabin, she established Vertical Clay, a company specializing in construction using vernacular building techniques. She has lectured on natural building at UC Berkeley, UC Santa Cruz, and Clayworks International. She designed a community center for the Hopi Reservation in Arizona and continues to work with Builders Without Borders. She currently is teaching at the University of San Francisco Architecture and Engineering Department and the University of Santa Clara Department of Engineering. Current projects include an earthen pagoda for Clark's Island in Lake County, California, and the remodeling of a conventional building using earthen construction on the site of her own home in Villa Sobrante. So it's impossible to say why these kinds of things work out the way they do, but just suffice it to say that Massey's presence here at Swarthmore ties in with several lines of thinking that are really important to us at Swarthmore right now, and the first being an increasing interest in architecture across the disciplines. I've heard just many conversations from mathematicians to sociologists to a number of people who are integrating architecture into their syllabi. The second being the conversation, the big conversation, on strategic planning as it addresses knowledge, teaching, and learning. And the third being the global conversation on sustainability and our environment, an issue that is of particular importance to all of us here in the community. And so it doesn't take a lot of vision to see the practice of earth and building as being at the intersection of so many important lines of thinking here at the college. So with that, I give you Massey Burke, Earth Builder.
Well, I have one more thank you to give, and that's to Sid for having the idea to bring me back. And also to put up with me for 2 weeks, which has been, I've had a great time. So thank you so much. Okay, good. All right, so when I got here, I was asking Sid about my presentation. And, okay, there's a lot of different ways you can tell the story of Earth and Building and what it's about. And Sid summarized some of that, why I do this stuff, which is a large part of my presentation. And Sid said, well, this is your chance to have a manifesto. So I said, oh, I better come up with a manifesto. So I call this talk my mud manifesto. And if you're going to make a manifesto or present a manifesto, then you better say something provocative to start it, I guess. So I'm going to make the claim that natural building, and I'll talk more about what natural building is, natural building, among other tools, has great power to turn the boat around environmentally for our culture. And I'm going to attempt to express to you why I think so, after I tell you what natural building is and show you some of the pictures of what I've done with it. So natural building is the art of building with stuff that's around you. And some of the pictures that I'll show you in a bit will be traditional expressions of that art. But it utilizes a few very basic things. And one of the fun things about this presentation is that I'm talking to a lot of people who have been working with me all week. So you know a lot about this already. But natural building, I would say the backbone of natural building is clay soils. Clay soils aren't necessarily potter's clay. Clay soils are almost ubiquitous on the surface of the earth. They're very easy to come by unless you live in an area that's geologically very young. And so clay soils generally are the mineral subsoil wherever you are. And so it's a mineral soil with enough clay content to be sticky for construction. So that is ingredient number one in natural building. And as you can imagine, again, I'll get to this in a bit, but as you can imagine, this is used very differently in different places, even though it's probably the most consistent ingredient in natural construction. Anyway, ingredient number two is straw. This is sort of interesting because we live in a culture that practices industrial agriculture, which means that we have a lot of straw around. It's considered a waste product. And I'm going to resist a tangent right here, but that's not true in many parts of the world. I've had people who practice natural building in other cultures come to America and say, oh my goodness, you're making these expensive buildings because they're making straw bale buildings. You know, they just don't have that kind of straw around. But for our purposes, straw is the number two ingredient in almost any type of natural building. The third ingredient is sand and or gravel. And straw and sand are added to the clay to balance out its tendency to shrink and the fact that it doesn't have a lot of tensile strength, so it doesn't have a lot of resistance to pulling forces. So those are the big three. When you're building vernacular building, you're probably using those ingredients in some form. And that's what we did this week. There are obviously other ingredients. There are many other things that could be considered part of natural building, other common ingredients, what I call non-industrial wood. So a lot of natural builders get into natural building because we don't want to build with wood. And then you figure out you got to make a roof. So you learn carpentry backwards or whatever. But what I mean by non-industrial wood is using wood that's not clear-cut, or it's managed, it's taken from an ecosystem in a way that is manageable. And that can mean different things depending on what kind of forest ecosystem you're talking about. This particular photo is of a tree that's called Madrone from California. It's kind of a special tree. It's anything but straight, but people have been learning how to use it, kind of pretending like it's straight, in timber frames and other things. Bamboo, and I'll talk more about this later. Very interesting building material. It's actually a big grass, so it should be in the category with straw, which is also a grass. But of course it has its own properties, so it gets its own category. And stone. If you're lucky enough to have stone and you can use it in an area that's not prone to a lot of earthquakes, then of course it's a great natural building material. And we were lucky enough to have some really cool stone for the project that we've been working on. All right, so with those materials, you can make a whole list of different parts of a building. And I'm going to run through those really quick. So cob is the one that you're all familiar with at this point, or most of you. You mix clay and sand and straw with your feet. Some people get really into it. Really into it. And then you stack it up on a foundation, and you trim it. So that's me trimming right there. And some people really get into this, too. That's one of my apprentices from a few years ago, several years ago. And you can see, but the cool thing about that picture is you can see the lift of cob drying, and then the cob below that is dry cob. Okay, so what I'm doing in this section is talking about a material or a wall system that can be made out of the basic ingredients of natural building, and then showing you an example of that. So this is a cob house. This is the first permitted cob house in Northern California in Willits, and it was actually built by a single mother and her kids. And it's one thing about natural building is that permitting it can be somewhat complicated. Okay, Adobe is probably a technique that you've heard of. Adobe is the practice of making, it's exactly like Cobb, so you mix stuff up. You can see they were mixing on the tarps. But you make blocks out of it and dry those in the sun, and then those get stacked into a wall. And that's mortared with clay, so actually you can see that better in that photo. The little rocks in there, this is a Adobe project in process in Mexico, and they stick the rocks in there to get good plaster adhesion.
Why would you use bricks as opposed to cob? What's the advantage or disadvantage?
So that's a good question. The main advantage is that you can, if you, you can stash up a lot of blocks first. So you can just sort of make blocks, make blocks, make blocks, and then when you're ready to make a building, you can make a building really fast because they're all dry. And so Adobe, once the blocks are dry, goes way faster than cob. And so it kind of depends on your workforce. So Adobes I use a lot when it's not a seismic issue and I have big volunteer groups because, and the other thing is, from that perspective, there's inherent quality control. So you can tell if a block is not integrated, but when you're integrating a cob wall, you can't necessarily see if there's a, like, kind of have to watch everything that's going on. And so if you have a whole bunch of people making Adobes, then you can use blocks selectively and use ones that aren't as strong higher in the wall or whatever. And then the main disadvantage is that Adobe's not nearly as strong seismically than as Cobb. That's the main distinction. Okay, so these guys are making Adobes and letting them dry. And then you're, I think, probably familiar with Adobe traditions in the Southwest. And so they often look a good bit like this. And that is actually, that's a church in Taos. Straw bale construction. So obviously a lot less clay in this. You bale straw and you stack that into a wall and then you plaster it. And you can plaster it with earth, which works really nicely. Or you can plaster it with various other kinds of things. And bales, as you can imagine, are the most vulnerable to water damage. So you really have to get them off the ground and put a big roof on them. But bale buildings, this is a finished bale building. And so they tend to be more rectilinear than other types of natural building. They're also getting pretty common in California because one of the reasons is that several years ago they passed a ban on burning the rice straw in the Central Valley. And so there's all this rice straw that farmers didn't know what to do with, and they all got behind, you know, this testing that is required for bale construction. And so it's a good bit easier to permit a bale building than other types of natural building in California. Also because, if you think about it, it fits really nicely into the way we think about buildings. It's just these modular blocks that get put into a shape, you know. And so you don't have to change the way you contract the labor all that much for straw bale. So.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
The external supports of those columns, they're serving to also support the roof across the
yeah.
structure?
Mm-hmm. And this one, I think, so when you do straw bale, and I didn't mention this, but for any of these techniques, the ones I've shown so far, they can either be load-bearing or non-load-bearing. So Adobe, Cobb, and straw bale have the capacity to hold up a roof. For bales, it depends on what kind of bales you get, and it also depends on the climate. Like, if you're in a really wet climate, probably you want to use them as infill, because it's easier if they really get wet, it's easier to repair. But in any case, so what you're looking at there, I think this is a non-load-bearing straw bale, in which case there's wood in that plaster, too, and you're looking at the porch. Yeah. This is also in Northern California. Another technique called light straw clay. This is from Germany, and our name for it is a sort of awkward translation of Leichtlehm, which is the German word for it. And it's a non-load-bearing system, so you require some kind of a frame, which is, I mean, usually wood, and it can be, you know, big timbers, or it can be more like stick framing. And this is a technique I'll return to in some of the projects I'll talk about. But it's basically a mix of mostly straw with a little bit of clay slip that's packed in between the vertical wooden structural members in the building for insulation and also for the surface to plaster. And so here you can see it. You can see the form is at the top. You just leap a form up the wall as you fill the wall in. This is a light straw house. Again, they tend to be rectilinear. This is designed and built by a man named Robert Laporte, who specializes in timber frames and light straw houses. And let's see how these next few images might be blurry, but I pilfered a few. They're not too bad. These are the interiors of his houses, and I love to show these because he probably makes the most normal natural buildings. And so it gives people a good sense that, you know, if you want to build this way, it doesn't mean it has to be this wavy, crazy thing. You know, any of the techniques that I've shown you can be finished like this. Yeah. So again, these are slightly low res, but you can see just, and he specializes in Japanese timber framing, so there's always this one curvaceous beam. They like that. And everything else is totally straight. And all these plasters, by the way, are earthen plasters, which I'll talk about just a little bit. It's not a focus of this presentation, but the same materials you put through a screen, and so you make them very fine, and that is used on the wall as a plaster. And you can, it'll go about as fine as you have patience for, basically. All right, so now we're getting into a family of walls that are called wattles, and which means woven walls. And these interest me a lot structurally because they're ridiculously strong, especially when you have clay-reinforced straw weaving one direction, as is the case in this picture, and stiff verticals going the other direction. This is called clay wattle. Somebody just made up the name because I don't know of any vernacular precedent for this. Like a lot of the techniques I'm talking about, we got from old traditions, and I will talk about that. But this one kind of just got made up because we didn't have the right material for a traditional wattle, which is the next technique I'll show you. But this, you make these ropes of clay and straw, and you weave them in and around the uprights, which are here. I think those are fir poles, just like saplings. But bamboo works really well. And I've actually even seen people use wire. And so it acts as an armature for the weave. And then once it dries, it's incredibly strong. And it has a kind of strength that some of the other earthen walls don't have. And so without getting too far into it, this particular system needs to be structurally tested. So we know more about it. These are a couple of apprentices weaving a wall. You can see they're halfway up. And that's the finished wall. In this case, so they did bottle art. Those are recycled bottles. And they also chose to keep a little bit of the texture that you get. So that's a plastered clay wattle wall. This is traditional wattle and daub, without the daub. So the daub refers to plaster. This is split bamboo with small bamboo verticals. The verticals are whole bamboo, and then you split it to run the other way. And this is often the infill that's used in those incredible Japanese farmhouses. So if you can imagine the farmhouse with the thatch and the roof line that does this, there's big timbers in the walls, and they were often infilled with this technique, and then earth plastered on both sides, or lime plastered. Here's some wattle I saw in India, and here's what it looks like plastered. So that's also a wattle and daub wall. And actually, behind the guy who's standing there, that's a form of, I think that's, oh no, it's not. There is also compressed earth block in this building, which is similar to adobe, and I thought that's what's behind him, but it's not. It's in the lower story. So this is in Western India. And it's interesting because this is not the traditional earthen construction. This is a reinvention of earthen building that's happening in this part of India. And there's also an old tradition of earthen building where they build these round houses called bungas in this part of India. And so they're actually, in other parts of this building, they draw on both traditions. But obviously this is very modern. and then this is just to illustrate the strength of woven bamboo. We were messing around making a woven bamboo dome. So that's entirely woven out of bamboo splits. And these guys were jumping around on it. So you can see it's just being held up by the weave. It's basically a monster basket, which is a valid way to make a building, even a bigger one than this one. Okay, so yeah. And then plasters. I was actually thinking this slide was later on, but this is here to talk about earthen plasters a little bit. You saw a few slides of earthen plasters when I was showing you the light straw buildings that Robert Laporte builds. This is probably the most upscale project I've ever done. And I can't remember if it's in my project section also, but this is a house in Napa that's this way upscale green house. And some of the plasters on the wall, I just did the plasters. The plasters on the walls are, some of them are cement reinforced earth. And then the fireplace there is a red clay that I dug up in an area that I work, where I work and then refined it. But it was really cool because, you know, as with almost any building project, at least in California, half of the framing crew is Mexican. And so I show up and I'm you know, doing what they do in Mexico on this, you know, $7 million house in Napa. We're just like, what is this? What's happening? You know, what are you doing? And it was cool. And I am going to speak to that later. That's actually one of my sub-thesis points. What's happening when very wealthy Americans choose to use these techniques? It's really interesting. It's really interesting culture. It's very important culturally. And that was one of my favorite experiences. And actually, this is also a very rectilinear building, and their cultural aesthetic in Mexico is very rectilinear, and so I had to get the corners really square and stuff. And actually, one of the Mexican masons asked me out because he saw that my corner was so square. Like, wow, I think I'm complimented. So other examples of plasters. These are from Bill and Athena Steen, who have been doing straw bale construction and art plastering forever, and they just do cool stuff with earth plasters. So that's a couple of different kinds of, and that's a sculpted, obviously, earthen plaster. More of their work in Builders Without Borders install, and actually that, the color in that is way hyped up. It's not quite so fluorescent. It's a bunch of natural colors, but it's different earth and lime plasters. And what I love about their work is they really do a lot of revealing of the fiber, so you can see the sort of specks of stuff around the square, which is revealing the straw bale. They sponge their plasters back so the straw fibers shine through, which I think is just very beautiful. And they do it kind of better than everybody else. And then this is something I was playing with. You can do bas-relief plaster stuff on pretty much anything. And so that's lime plaster on a little sleeping nook in a remodel that I'm working on.
When you say lime plaster, distinguish that from the earth plasters.
It's a it's just another kind of a binder. And so if you think of what's the best... has anybody seen those... Have you seen lath and plaster houses? That's the form you're most likely to find it in this country, but it's basically limestone that's been burned, and so that it becomes reactive, and you mix that with sand, and it hardens back into limestone on your wall. And so a lot of the old lath and plaster buildings are lime plaster, so lime, sand, and horsehair. So it's a white plaster. I might save this for the question period, but basically the plasters that you want to use on natural buildings are ones that are vapor permeable. You don't want to use finishes that seal off a wall, because the buildings can actually handle a fair amount of water vapor and even liquid water as long as it can get out again. And so you have to design for that. And so earth plasters do that really well. Lime plasters do it well. Cement plasters do it very poorly. And then there's a few other, there's mixes you can make. But for finishes, you generally see earth-based plasters or lime-based plasters. And again, that's like a whole category of discussion. So if people would like to ask about that at the end, I'm happy to talk about it. This is an earthen floor. So it's basically a horizontal plaster, but you seal it with linseed oil, several coats of linseed oil, and it becomes hard. If you travel in Mexico, you might see earthen floors sealed with ox blood or motor oil, which I've never done either of those things. But traditionally, they are sealed with ox blood. So the protein basically becomes a glue. And they're totally beautiful. So another thing you can do with these materials. Okay, so what have people been doing with these materials around the world for centuries? This is going to be a very brief jaunt through some of the vernacular building traditions. This is in Mali, and this is very emblematic of how they build. They have a very strong architectural language in Western Africa. And Mali, in particular, is famous for this style where you have these very strong linear elements. And actually, this one's more linear than some of them. I think this is a newer one. But some of them are very... these curved buttresses, and they're these vertical buildings. And I'll show you the next slide, which is a famous... This is an older one. This is the Great Mosque at Jenne, the Friday Mosque. That has been in existence for several hundred years and is probably the most famous example of its type. And the wood that's sticking out, they replaster this every year. Not that you have to do that with natural building. It has more to do with the climate and how it's built. In this case, the plaster is the only weather protection, and so it needs to be replastered as an earth plaster. But they build those wooden things into the wall so you can climb up the building and replaster it every year. And they're also structural. And so I'm told, and I'm not sure if this is just like natural building urban legend, that they divide the thing in half and race, the town does. Do they actually do that? Yeah. That's only hearsay, but I've heard that a few times. I don't remember the actual date. It's several hundred years old, and I think it was rebuilt at least once. I think there was a... I don't know the history of this part of the world very well, but at some point... a hostile cultural force was in power in this area, and they actually stopped up the gutters and let the rain destroy the mosque, and then it was rebuilt. And that was at least a couple hundred years ago. Do you know? I don't know the exact dates, but it's been around.
The French rebuilt it in the 19th century.
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah, and I think it might have even been before. So it might have been rebuilt twice, but at least once it was like massively rebuilt, not just restored, because this person that I can't remember intended to destroy it. And I guess you can't actually, like, destroy a mosque. You can just sort of enhance the weathering process. And so that's what he did. He stopped at the gutters. This is an amazing earthen building tradition in Ghana and Burkina Faso. And I think this is specifically Burkina Faso, where they actually polish their whole house. So if you work with clay, you know that you can burnish clay. And so you can put pressure on it at a certain water, when it's at a certain, has a certain degree of water in it, and put pressure on it and make it a polished surface. And so you can imagine doing that to a pot, but these guys do it to their entire buildings. And the color that you're seeing is local pigments, and some of it I think is plant pigments, mostly mineral pigments from clays, and then they add some sort of latexy plant additive to it to make it shinier and also a little bit more waterproof. But this, again, is the kind of tradition where it's renewed quite frequently. And I have a lot of pictures of this just because it's so cool. I mean, just ridiculously beautiful, very strong tradition. In many of these traditions, the women are the plasterers, and sometimes they're the builders, which is pretty cool. Okay, so to Europe for a minute. I mentioned earlier that Lightstar Clay was from Germany. This is considered one of the oldest houses in Germany, and the sort of catch-all German term for timber framing is Fachwerk. And so it just means timber with stuff infilled. And that can be brick, or it can be something, they don't really do adobe. It can be wattle and daub, or it can be light straw clay, which is that packed straw with a little bit of clay slip that I showed you. This, I believe, was built in 1289. And so it's quite old, and there are many of these houses. This is not an anomaly. And so many of the timber frames that have been infilled with earthen materials, have been continuously inhabited for hundreds of years, even in Europe. The other well-known tradition of this is in England. This is where we get Cobb. So Cobb actually kind of, this is not actually in Devon, I don't think. It might be. But Devon is the area of England where they have a subsoil that's kind of like Cobb ready mix. And so it's got nice proportions of sand and clay. And they just sort of mix it up and throw a little bit of straw on it and pile it on the wall. And so they have these walls that are, 4 feet thick. And again, some of these houses have been continuously inhabited for 600 years. And also note the really awesome thatching. So Northern European thatch traditions are really cool, and they're highly skilled. It's one of the natural building traditions that I have not had a chance to study yet, but it's, it's taking reeds, usually of a type like Phragmites, which you can find around here. It's actually a non-native species, but common in this area. And it takes acres and acres to do one thatch. But if these thatches are made properly, they last 70 years. I think in some cases for renewing them, they just add on top, and in other cases, they'll rethatch the building. These are usually lime plastered, actually, going back to your lime, like the whitewashed buildings. This one looks like it's not plastered at all. It's just trimmed cob, if I had to guess. And then a couple of totally out there traditions. This is an entirely reed, speaking of reeds, this is a reed tea house in Iraq, near, I believe, the Euphrates River, and they just bundled the reeds up and made them into a building. And I think what really blows me away about this is how big it is. I mean, you can see these dudes sitting down here. And then bamboo construction. So Colombia is the birthplace of really dramatic bamboo construction, and the personality that sort of headed that up is this man named Simon Velez. So Colombia has a lot of this type of bamboo called Wadua angustifolia. It's known vernacularly as timber bamboo, and there are other species that are also in that category, but it's huge. I mean, the bamboo is this big sometimes. And so you can do lots of things with it that we can't do with our temperate bamboos, like this. This is a bridge built by a man named Jörg Stamm. And every single piece in that bridge is probably, it's probably 5 or 6 inch diameter bamboo from that area. What's interesting about this, and this is something I am going to sort of touch upon more. Bamboo is considered a poor person's building material. Even wadua is considered a poor person's building material in Colombia. And they do various things with it. They sort of flatten it out to make this plywood. And a lot of their buildings before Simon Velez got into it were just kind of stick frame bamboo, just verticals and infilled with various things. And their word for like a wattle and daub is bahareque. And so, again, just woven panels with mud on them. And then Simon Velez was an architect. And so he came from, I think, a wealthy family in Colombia and said, I'm going to be the bamboo architect. And so he took bamboo and really explored what it could do and what it liked to do as a material. And his most famous building is the Zeri Pavilion at the World Fair that was in Germany. And it's this enormous, you know, there's no right angles in the whole thing, all these angular, it's a round pavilion. That might be the biggest bamboo structure in the world, I'm not sure. But it's not in this slideshow, but I highly recommend Googling it, the Zeri Pavilion, if you're into bamboo. Okay, so that's a very quick jaunt through some of the world's vernacular building traditions or natural building traditions, old and newer. So this is obviously newer construction, but it's tapping into a very old vernacular tradition. All right, so I want to show you a few things that I've worked on. This is the interior of the house that I did my apprenticeship on. So it's the first building I worked on. And you can see there's a lot of wood in it. It's in an area of Northern California where there's a lot of small Douglas fir. And so they're actually removing them to keep the right wood balance in the oak woodlands, because previously the oak woodlands were burned. And that's difficult to do politically anymore. And so they remove the trees manually instead. And they use them in building. And so this is actually what's considered a hybrid natural house. And so the back wall is straw bale. The wall that you're looking at is cob. And then the loft upstairs is light straw clay. There's the outsides. And this is, again, this is in Northern California. That's the front of it. This is a guest house that I built, or a guest cabin is probably more accurate. This is in an organic walnut orchard in Northern California. And you have to remember this for the last section of my talk, which is about Lake County and the effect, the greater effects that natural building can have. This was kind of the beginning of some of that. But again, the bigger section is straw bale, and the little round section is a sleeping nook, and that's cob. There's the other view, with leftover adobes at the bottom. One view of the inside. There you go. There's some lime plaster. So it's just white plaster and sand. And that's also, that is an earthen floor. You can see a little bit of it. This... might be my most whimsical building. This is an indoor-outdoor shower house for the intern village at the Solar Living Institute in Hoplands. And it's really exploring the shapes that Earth likes to take. I love arches. Arches are cool structurally because they're entirely compressive structures, meaning that the loads are transferred by pressing on the material, not by stretching the material. So Earth is great in compression, and it's disastrously bad in tension unless you add something to it. So arches are awesome for earthen construction. And also, I had a situation where, you know, you've all experienced how much work it is to make cob. So this building did not need to be entirely enclosed. And so I wanted to make holes wherever possible, so I didn't have to make all that cob because, you know, it wasn't like a huge budget project or anything. There's part of the inside. And this was built in great part with the interns who stay at this site when they're interning there. That's the outdoor shower. All sorts of crazy stuff in it. You can see the curvature of the indoor shower, which is actually a dome. It's an earth bag dome. And there's part of the interior, again, with arches. I like that just because it shows off, again, how much freedom you have with the material. You can kind of bring it out and make candle ledges or whatever. Again, you saw this. So that was probably the most whimsical building. This is probably the most upscale, straight-laced building I've ever worked on. Earth plaster in this very expensive house in Napa. And again,
Is that mica or what for the glass?
Oh, it's just a regular... That was a masonry fireplace that was put... Oh. It's fire, you know, whatever, tempered glass. So I was, again, I was responsible for the finishes only in this particular picture. This was a fun project. This was a natural building install as part of a big green expo that took place in Washington, D.C. Started, I think, the year before Obama's inauguration. And so we built this arch and then also a little straw bale building on the terrace of the U.S. Botanic Gardens. And as you can see, the Capitol is, you know, across the street. And we were doing what we were doing. You know, we have been doing here, mixing cob with our feet, sort of right there. And the congressmen and senators were walking by on the street behind the arch and sort of, you know, what are you doing? And getting interested. It was cool. And it was a temporary install as part of this expo. But they decided to leave it so that it could be up for Obama's inauguration, and then it was taken down. But I think in terms of proportions, I'm just fond of this project. Oh, you know, I'm realizing this is actually, just so you know, that's elongated. The arch looks really tall and skinny. It's being distorted by the projector. It's a Roman arch. Okay, so this is a series of public works projects that I've been doing in Lake County. So Lake County is an area north of San Francisco that doesn't have much of an economy. And it also has a pretty disastrously bad housing stock. And so I'll just go through the work itself, and then I'm going to back up and talk about kind of the other implications of that trajectory. So the first project was in Lucerne Creek Park. And I love this picture because they let me put Adobe on top of the sign. That sign was there before we did the project, and we're like, well, how are we going to tie in a bunch of curvy natural buildings to this concrete sign? And I asked if I could put mud on top of the sign, and they said, well, yeah, I guess so. And I like how it came out. there's the rest of the install. It's what I call a sitting wall. So this was cool. A colleague of mine ran for county supervisor in Lake County with the intention of introducing more ecological practices up there, and talked everybody into, instead of what they usually do in these situations is just put a bunch of boulders so people won't drive onto this area and park on it. And she said, well, can't we do this community building thing instead? And everybody said, okay. You know, so they said, okay, $5,000. Do something. And so I said, well, we can make a sitting wall and maybe a few other things. And I really had no idea who was going to turn up. And 60 people ended up showing up to help me over the course of 2 weeks. And this is in a community where most people are older. A lot of people are disabled. There's all sorts of meth problems. So that's pretty interesting. So it's just an adobe. It's a cob wall, actually. The base of it is stacked recycled concrete. And the top is recycled redwood. So that's our roof cap in that case. And then we did end up building a little arched bench at the back. And this was what came out of that project. So down the road, in another part of Lake County, there's a man-made island that's been acquired by the county. It's called Clark's Island. And it got zoned as an eco-park, but nobody really knew what that was. And so the community that's the host of this town has decided to define that for themselves. And so they decided that part of that was natural building. And so we made a very straight-up adobe sign to begin with. There it is again. It's kind of fun. It's right by a gas station. A little bit incongruous. And this is from one of the reasons that it's really fun to build in Lake County is that they have gorgeous building clay. It's beautiful red stuff. So this is an arched roofed sitting area. So it's kind of like a long bench with a corner to it. And it's not purple. This is, again, something that the projector is doing. It's brown clay down here, and the red clay is not quite that red. Here's another picture of it. And behind it, you can see that the bridge is heading over to the island. One more view of that. And that led to, so I've been finishing up details on those little things, and then we're in the design process for the pagoda, which is going to be the centerpiece of the islands, which is will be the biggest thing I've ever built. It's scheduled to be built next year, next building season. This was a conceptual sketch for it. So it's another whimsical building. It's a spiral building. It needs to be mostly open so security can see through the building at night because there are a lot of vagrants and all sorts of, you know, people who just like to trash things, unfortunately. I know they do. there's a population up there that is, it's hard to know how to relate to them. But in any case, so the people who are in charge of the park requested that if we build a building there, they just need to be able to see what's happening in it. So there's a lot of arches. And actually, there are more, everybody liked this just little sketch, but there are more arches in this than you can accomplish structurally with earth. And so the intersection is going to be bamboo reinforced earth. I'm currently working on the design and engineering of this building. So that's the scale of that is about 30 feet. And so I'm currently working on the engineering of this with two different architecture and engineering programs in the Bay Area. And it's fun because there's no precedent for figuring out how this works structurally, as far as I know. I mean, there's things that are kind of similar, but and so I don't have, you know, I don't have like the drawing because we're experimenting with different layouts and what's actually going to stabilize that center ring with all the arches in it and stuff. So these are some of the students' renderings I've been getting early this semester. with different things you could do. We need the, our engineer says we need these two. So the building, was everybody liked the idea of a spiral. And then the engineer said, oh, you got to have these arms that come off to stabilize that center part. And so we're playing around spatially with how, what we do with those. So the students are playing around with that. Those are a couple of ideas. And then, again, this is the bamboo that we have there to work with. This is pretty big. This is the, we were harvesting from this grove to test the bamboo that we'll use in the construction of the pagoda. We need to get structural numbers for the actual bamboo fiber. So it came from this nursery. This is one of the species. And this species, actually, the guy, by the way, for people who are working with me, is the same as the stuff that we cut. But this gets to about 5 inches in the Bay Area. It's called Japanese timber bamboo. But it's mostly the same as the stuff down by the train station. And then my other current project is my house. And it's a natural building remodel, mostly. And we've been working on the secondary unit. That's what it looked like. So I live in a house that we call Villa Sobrante, and it's actually two buildings and a bunch of space in the backyard that I bought with three of my good friends 3 years ago. And the intention, and it's in the Bay Area, it's close to Berkeley, the intention is to bring natural building into the urban context. So, you know, we have a lot of urban spaces, we have a lot of urban buildings that need to be improved in some way, and a lot of people assume that natural building is not really relevant in urban areas. And there are definitely challenges for sure, but we thought, well, we kind of think somebody just needs to do it. So the buildings on this property are these two funky little stick frame stuccoed, you know, kind of basic California houses, nothing special. And also, as far as we knew, there had never been a permit issued for this in this county, and our intention was to set a permit precedent. So if you set a precedent with a building technique, then it makes it easier for someone else to come along and do the same thing at the county level, or sometimes at the city level. So we decided we wanted to use light straw clay to remodel this building, which is the clay straw thing I showed you. This is what it looked like before. And we had to pour the foundation. This is a blurry picture, but you can see now the straw is in between the studs there. Inside. So it's half done. Here's Kieran plastering the ceiling. We put foam in the ceiling, actually, and then plastered directly onto the foam. And this is where we're at right now with it. There's a little more trim that needs to go in and finish plaster on the walls, but it's pretty close. And the ceiling is my favorite part. So you can see a little bit. It's kind of a vaulted ceiling. And we also are building small buildings in the backyard. And what's nice is that if you build smaller than 120 square feet, you don't need a permit. And so these are my learning buildings. And so if there's something that's been kicking around in my head, I build a little building. And this one is mostly, it's a form of rammed earth and cob and some other things. And you can see, we got some recycled big bamboo, and those are the rafters for the roof. You can see it at different stages. The bags there are actually, they contain, that's a form, it's a type of building called earth bag construction, which is like rammed earth, and I haven't told you about it, but it's another form of natural building. Yeah, again, in progress. And there you go. So that's the finished building. And the detail is hard to see, but the mesh around the lower roof is actually a living roof edge. The windows are recycled. And this is my building. It's in progress. This is one of the other little buildings. It's a woven bamboo earthen vault. And I'm working on the roof structure in this picture. And so it has a lifted, curving roof, and there's a couple different roof sections. And the hole that you see in that window is going to become a pair of opening doors. And a few other components. There's a detail of the bamboo roof construction, and that actually is a setup for a sealed lime plaster. So the waterproofing will be lime plaster and some tile, probably. And this is one of the trusses for a long extended roof off the side of the building. And a lot of what I've gotten interested in is the structural use of small bamboo, because there's small bamboo all over the world. Often it's not considered a building material. It's usually present in these disaster areas. And so if you begin to test it structurally, then that has international implications. And so I showed you the picture of the grove that we took our testing bamboo from a few slides back. And we're doing that with an eye to being able to develop construction protocols for smaller bamboos as well as, you know, timber bamboo. Okay, so Going through those slides took longer than I thought, and I think I know I can run over a little bit, but probably not a huge amount, huh?
Probably, I don't know how many more slides you have, but we want to just have time for questions.
Time for questions. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to go through this pretty quick, I think, but I think the why is important. So why for me, so generally, why do we bother with buildings ecologically? And I think you probably all know this, but here's a good rundown. The way that we create and inhabit buildings in this country is fairly high impact at this point. And the way that you can deal with that, there's many different good tools for dealing with that. Natural building is definitely one of them. I think high-tech buildings are also one of them, and then it just depends on how you combine those two things. But whatever tools you use, these are some of the problems we need to deal with when we look at our built environment. But for me, I started doing natural building because for a lot of reasons, but one of them was because I need, I studied humanities. I need beauty in my life. But I need beauty that's not coming at the cost of somebody else, somebody else having beauty. And so I just got really interested in, what can you do, with what you have, and you can more or less see the impact that it makes. And a point that I like to make on the building site, but I don't know if I have done that, is that if you do the mixing yourself and the building yourself of Cobb, you're personally experiencing the embodied energy in that building. That's all the energy that it takes, to make a building, except that when we do stick framing or other kinds of industrial construction, you just don't experience that. You don't have any reference for, what it takes to refine a material and turn it into a human space. And so natural building kind of lets you do that. And so I would say starting with natural building was kind of a personal investigation into how do you live well, comfortably, not because I also feel like so much of sustainability is, eat your granola and, do less of this and do less of that. And just, it's a lot of don'ts. It can be really difficult to see where creativity can be engaged. And so I needed a tool that was about being creative, about, adding something positive, just not just subtracting a negative behavior. And so natural building, it's a helpful tool to think about that with, at least. And I think in some ways it is a way to create human space where you do have some idea of the impact. But I'm going to tell two stories that are why I think natural building is so relevant to our culture. And the first story has to do with this technique that I learned in India. This is a decorative earth plaster technique. It's called lipan. It's just the filigree stuff. This is a wall from my house in El Sobrante. And they screen clay and horse manure to make the mix. So it's very simple. And they are very particular about this. It's from Gujarat and a region called Kutch. And they mostly decorate inside with this technique. So I went to India, basically because my parents decided they wanted to go. And so I said, well, okay, I'll go visit. And we went to this part of India first, just because I knew vaguely that there was some earthen building going on there. And I didn't know anything about India when I went, and it's huge. And so this was a bit random, but I was there with a good friend of mine, and we said, okay, we're going to go find this earthen building tradition in Gujarat. And these are three members of the Rabari tribe. And they're semi-nomadic. They're the cattle herders of Western India. The way things work in India is that your guest house owner, you say, well, I kind of want to do this. And then they pull all these strings. And, we tried to control this process for a long time. It doesn't work. And then they just kind of say, okay, get in this car, and then you're going to go out into the desert, and there'll be someone who will show you how to do this. You're like, okay. And so we did, and we end up at this tent with these women who are dressed like this. And this is just totally a gratuitous picture of cute Indian children. But they're standing against a bun wall. There you go. There's an adobe wall behind them. Incredibly adorable. But this is Parma, and she's here standing in front of some of her decorative work. And she taught us how to do this. This is not Parma. This is someone else. But she's beginning a mud work decorative form. And they improvise it completely. They just start and begin to infill with this sculptural plaster. And these people live with very, very little. I mean, they have these incredible clothes, and they come from a craft region of India that's famous within India and also outside of India, but, I mean, they live in tents on the ground. And so we got to sit there, and Parma taught us very strictly how to mix this stuff, and how to sculpt with it. And what you can't see in this photo is that there's this ring of Indian men and women just sort of watching this happening, you know, where there's a strange Western woman who's in the mud with the, you know, and again, I mean, it's what's so interesting about doing natural building is no matter where you are, somebody is surprised. And it's true when you're building, you know, on the Capitol lawn, and it's true when you're doing earthen building in India, where it's native, because they don't have a lot of Westerners come through and want to just get into what they're doing, you know. And so the very act of taking interest in a traditional culture as a Westerner at this point is very significant, because they are losing faith and interest in their own traditions right about the time that we're discovering that we're going to need them. And obviously we're not going to starve if we don't know how to do lipan, but it was a very accessible technique. It was easy to latch onto. I could learn it in 2 hours. She could teach me with no English. And then the whole village sort of watched this, have this sort of exchange of information happen, this exchange of cultural information. So I made some other friends in that part of India, and they happened to come visit us the next summer. So here you have exactly the same thing happening, except in my backyard. And so this is Ramu, who's a quilt maker, but also from this part of India, and one of my good friends, Bob Tice, who's an architect. And I didn't know it, but he'd been wanting to learn this technique for like 20 years. And so I sent out a random email saying, hey, we have these friends from India. We're going to do this technique on our wall. You know, anybody's welcome. And I get an email from Bob saying, I'll be there in 10 minutes. Okay. And so I want to go through these quick because it's just the process of the wall being made. So there's Ramu again. Ramu was my age. He'd never left his village in India. And he handled showing up in a house full of four single women fairly well, coming from a traditional culture. But Himanshu is my friend who is with him, and he's not in this photo, and he spoke English. But I never knew if I was getting straight translations or not, so I have no idea what Ramu thought of all this. But he certainly led us through this process, so there's Bob learning. And also what I love about this is the context. So it's just like totally straight up, motorboats, you know, stick frame houses. When Ramu wasn't doing this, he was so tired of American food that he would just cook curry and sit on our floor and eat it. He was either doing this or eating curry. This is one of my apprentices from a couple years ago. There's Himanshu, so he's the translator. There he is again. And we were getting what we call, people would drive by and just screech to a halt and back up and look at this wall because it was so incongruous. And so the neighbor showed up and just sort of started asking about it. I can't remember where these guys came from. A bunch of kids showed up. I mean, I think it was organized, but they didn't just wander in. And then I love these. These are context pictures. So we're finishing the wall, and this is the environment that it's set in, and that is the front of our house. What I find so valuable about this is that there's so few things that are really two-way streets between cultures that are not yet industrialized and cultures that are industrialized. And I know that's a dichotomy that's oversimplifying, but it's so rare that we both ways have something to really offer each other. And so again and again, I've had these experiences in natural building where there's this honest conversation going on that's, you know, both sides know that they have a lot to benefit from the other culture. And this particular exchange of lipan is just one little iota of that. Because in the industrialized world, we're learning that, you know, technology can be a big mess, not necessarily, but it often is. And there's a lot to be said for traditional ways of doing things. And they can be combined with, you know, very sophisticated understanding of materials and updated and everything else. But the people who have been practicing them for thousands of years are where we're getting the ideas in the first place. And the people who have been practicing them for thousands of years often are losing their traditions for various reasons. And so when they watch, like I said, when they watch wealthy Americans get interested, truly interested in what they do, then it often has a reversal effect on, you know, that cultural erosion in their own, in where they live. So that is story number one. Story number two is the story of Lake County. So Denise, my colleague, became a county supervisor in a fairly conservative county and decided she was going to run on an ecological design platform and got elected. And then she had taken a class from me right before that, and so she was familiar with natural building and asked me to build that guest house that I told you to remember in her walnut orchard. She moved to Lake County, bought an organic walnut orchard, and got elected county supervisor. And so, as you might imagine, she's a little bit remarkable. She's 50, I think. And so she got this off the ground, a very small public works project, just to show people that natural building is possible. You know, and like I said, there's this whole swath of incredible red clay covering Lake County. And so they have this abundant building material all around them, but of course no tradition to use it. So project one was just get the idea out there that it's not going to melt. You know, so the conversations I have during project one are, don't you know that you can't build adobe in this climate? And then I explain why I think it'll be all right, you know, and now it's been through a few winters, and so people are comfortable with it. I think this is out of order again. This is project two. So that led to, all right, what can we do with Clark's Island? You know, so what building can we put on Clark's Island? And so then people think about, oh, pagoda or some full-on building that we might engineer. When you engineer it, you set a precedent. And then you begin to think about what goes around the building. Interesting. So we have this kind of blank slate of an island, and we're going to put a cool building in it, but then what? And then people start thinking about, well, we kind of have water quality issues to deal with, and then there's going to be some runoff, and then how is all this sort of tied together? So again, you can see this is Clark's Island, the park. It's not much on it, some fig trees. It's surrounded by an area of Lake County that's called the Keys, so it's a bunch of canals with houses on it, houses in and around the canals. Another view, so you can see down one of the canals. And a rickety old bridge. There used to be a trailer park on the island, and they took it off. And the bridge really shouldn't support vehicle traffic, but they were driving on it, and so it's been converted to a pedestrian bridge. But that's as far as they got. And then we did some of the natural building. The natural building, so we built the sign for Clark's Island. The natural building served to bring together a community group, a community design group. The cool thing about natural building, especially when people aren't expecting it, is that it's kind of the embodiment of creative ecological design on a bigger scale. If you imagine that you might collaborate creatively with an ecosystem, you know, there's all sorts of ways you can do that, and you're probably familiar with some of them. You know, you can create a wetland that's also a gray water system. You know, you can create ecosystems that help balance out human life and bring us more comfort, but also serve as life support for many other living things, you know, and so we're learning how to do that. And so natural building has this incredible centralizing force. It's sort of like it's a living system in a way because you're using biodegradable materials and they're local materials, but you get instant gratification. You know, if you make a wetland for treating your gray water, you don't get instant gratification. It takes several years and you have to tweak it for a while. But natural building is just sort of like you get to just do it. And so it's kind of the quickest direct experience people can have of beginning that creative relationship with ecosystem. And so you can strategize for that. You can kind of plan for it because it's fairly dependable, that dynamic. And so you can start to see people centralize around the project and realize that a community, and the other piece of it is that people are just in power. I mean, you can dig stuff out of the ground and make a building out of it. And so people think, well, now we can start somewhere. So they start with building, usually, and then they begin to talk about the context and what else can we do and what problems are we considering. And if you leverage that, then you can begin to feed that conversation. And Denise and I decided we want to try to do that just to see if it would work in Lake County. You know, this place that has no money, has a big lake that's got nutrient loading and algae blooms and runoff and heavy metals and everything else in it. So then we built the bench, which engaged, I think, a few hundred people from the community, I think. And then we proposed the pagoda, and so now and that drew in a university program. And so that kind of legitimized natural building for Lake County. It's like, oh, people outside of Lake County will be interested in this. And then the community group started to think, well, we need a master plan. So how do we ecologically design the whole island? And out of that came various wetland ideas and trying to figure out how the island can relate to the lake, you know, because the lake levels go up and down a lot. And also, how do we use... So there are riparian rights. We can use water from the lake to irrigate this island. Well, what if we create a landscape that returns the water to the lake cleaner than we took it out? So there's an idea. And these are sketches from the community group that came together after they had the experience of natural building to start to think about this other stuff. So a few sketches, trying to figure out how the pagoda relates to things. The first physical embodiment of that investigation into the greater ecology will be my last slide. This is a floating island, and I consider it to be a very good example of low-tech meets high-tech. A floating island is a recycled mat of plastic that imitates this phenomenon that happens in peat bogs, where the peat delaminates from the bottom of the lake, floats up to the surface, and vegetates itself. And the microbial community that lives in that mat of peat removes nutrients from the water at an incredibly high rate. And so it keeps the water clean and oxygenated and does various other things for the water ecosystem. And then the plants on top create habitat. And so you have this incredibly diverse, productive little unit of a system that occurs naturally and can be mimicked. And I don't necessarily know if I agree with, you know, mats of plastic being set afloat in bodies of water. I think there's arguments for and against that. But just the romance of the idea of a floating island or a floating garden caught everybody in Lake County, all sides of the political spectrum. You know, so it's just this cool, people just like plants, you know, living things, living systems, and creativity around living systems. And so Clark's Island now has two installations of floating islands planted with native plants just to see, you know, to see if we can try to monitor how much nutrients they remove, how many nutrients they remove, and what other things might be happening in the water column. So it's just this first step towards a two-way street between humans and non-human systems and how we might begin to participate regeneratively, not just destructively. And I love this photo for that because it's sort of this pathway leading out into the lake and you don't really know where you're going to end up. Thank you for coming. Any questions?
When you're building one of these arches about 10 feet high made of palm, mm-hmm. how do you keep it from collapsing as you're building it?
If you can, you build it really slowly. You build it really slowly, so you want it to dry as you go.
It dries as you build it.
That's ideally. What you do, you also use a form, usually.
Oh, you use a form.
Yeah, you don't have to, but it's way quicker to use a form, and then you just leave the form in there until it's dry. There are some really cool traditions that don't use forms, like they might not have enough wood, and they have these other ways of doing it, but I usually do it one of those two ways. Other questions? Yes?
I have a question about kind of the social context, the production that you mentioned, and there are two things that you said that to me were really kind of provocative. One was you just briefly mentioned that for this very expensive kind of wealthy family who commissioned the house in Napa mm-hmm. and how the workers were Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the one story. And then the other story that you shared about your visit to India.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about what you mean by there being equal exchange and asymmetry and needs and
it's a good question. I should probably qualify that by saying that it's my personal experience and I seem to observe that happening to some degree, but maybe more I see the intellectual recognition of it in some people that I have worked with, and so then I see the possibility of that. Probably the best way I can describe it is just that both, you know, okay, so to take the example of the house in Napa, you know, these guys who've moved up from Mexico and have lived in Napa for quite a while, you know, and they're doing fine, but they're working on the carpentry of this big mansion, and they see that techniques that are used from their hometowns that they remember, you know, are being used in this building. You know, that's these people who could have bought anything in the world decided they wanted to use that in the center of their house, as the centerpiece of the house. And what I have perceived several times is that I've talked to a lot of Mexicans, both here and in Mexico, who say, oh, mud building is no good, you know, we should build with concrete, obviously, it's not our place to tell them, no, you should be building with mud, you know, but you talk to others of them, and they kind of, they have a strange relationship to a lot of the industrial building practices that have come into Mexico. So the thing about concrete is that it doesn't really fit in most economies. It's very expensive. It produces an enormous amount of carbon dioxide, and it's introduced into places with very good intentions to create housing that's considered superior to the locally built housing. And in some ways it is, but it introduces this technique that is then for creation of housing in that area, you suddenly begin to have this dependence upon, you know, somebody who's going to show up with the next load of concrete blocks. And in some places that can be manufactured locally, in some places not. And so, but there is a cultural imbalance. You know, they perceive that anything coming from an industrialized country must be superior, or they is also, it's an overgeneralization, but you see it a lot when you travel and work with people in places like Mexico or India. And so when they see us using and taking interest in their techniques, it's probably not a politically correct thing to say, but it re-legitimizes it for them. Because we do have this economic imbalance. I've experienced this. So when after Ramu, who was just working with his traditional technique at our house, I heard from Himanshu after he went home, and Ramu had said, I think I'm gonna decorate our kitchen with Lipan. Because they've kind of lost faith. And so I kind of feel like our true interest in the skills they've cultivated for 10,000 years is what we have to bring to them, and what they have to bring to us is the fact that they have cultivated these skills for 10,000 years. But it's just our attention that actually tips the scales sometimes. And so that's not a generalization I can make. I mean, I'm speaking very subjectively, and it's just something that I've experienced when I have worked with builders in other parts of the world. And so I don't know if I'm answering your question or not. Is it somewhat?
No.
Yeah.
I was just curious because the other side of it is, are they getting paid well for building in this way, or is it just like an aesthetic thing, I guess?
Oh, well, I mean, that question, at least my experience in California, is that they're all over the map in terms of how much they get paid. In this particular case, they were very skilled, and I think they were getting paid well, you know, on a par with, you know, carpenters. Obviously, other Mexican workers are not paid that way. I don't necessarily see that that's related to these techniques now. It had more to do with like a cultural exchange. You know, where we are going to get the ideas that at least I think are going to help us forward. You know, cultures that, because they haven't had anything except for what's around them, have been extraordinarily creative with what's around them. You know, yeah, so that's what I see. Other questions? Yes. Oh, yeah, though I feel like maybe some of the builders should do that. I'll start, and if anybody wants to jump in, please do. So we're building. So this is a fun project for me because I don't often get to practice natural building as an artistic medium. And so it is an artistic installation that is representing cob both as a practical material and as a beautiful material. And it's in conjunction with Sid's class, which is called the Containers Architecture. And so her students spent the first half of the semester designing the wall and making models of the wall, and now we're building it. And they'll spend a little bit of the second half completing the decorations on that wall. There'll be some plaster embellishments on the wall. And it's an exploration of clay both as a beautiful material and as a structural material. And I would like people who have been building with me to add to that, if you would like to, or people from the art department who have been working with me or supporting this project. Or,
well, I think that you've done a really good job in describing the intent of it. As the instructor for the class, the most important thing for me is that the students understand the breadth of usage for clay. The container as architecture implies we're looking at container, but also the idea of the container in a broader sense and clay in a broader sense, to actually think about the architectural associations given to an object such as a cup or a pitcher, and then how you can take those same associations outside into an actual object and use that same material and create an object that really engages the environment and really takes on the space around it. I think that what you're seeing out there now really shows how this object is having a conversation with the Science Center, with Beardsley, I mean, because of its scale, because of the textures, just because of the references that are beginning to appear in the form. So it's just taking that idea of architecture within a small object and expanding it and taking it out into the environment and seeing clay having that breadth of usage.
Actually, I want to add to that, and I'm sitting here thinking, I think a piece I didn't really emphasize well, and is definitely a piece of this project, is the community building aspect. Mm-hmm. And it was a piece that I kind of left out of my summary of the Lake County projects, I kind of touched on it, but because my talk is going so long, but people just came in and joined, and that is the other magic of natural building, is that it's kind of inviting. I mean, obviously you get very dirty, but it's not daunting, and there aren't big things with moving parts that are going to cut your fingers off. You know, you just sort of start doing it, and you can put a very small amount of mud on the wall or a very large amount. And so there's a very low barrier to entry, but it can be as sophisticated as you make it.
And it's pretty amazing the range of students that have come to the project, from engineers to biologists to just people in the humanities and across the divisions who are interested in doing this. Because the class has basically six people because of the size of the room and what we're trying to do. But the engagement has been broad. I mean, just there are at least 40 students that have signed up to work on it during the 2 weeks that we're working on it. So, and besides the faculty members who have shown up and the staff members, I mean, Paul Rablin, I have photos of him working it out with the clay, and Jeff Lott, and a number of people who haven't come to the art department wouldn't be thinking about architecture in the way that we're thinking about, and certainly in the process that we're using. And so it really has been, at its simplest manifestation, a real community builder.
And beyond the people who are working on building it, there's just like a constant flow of people who just walk by and ask questions about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that you see this building happening and see that it's a feasible thing, a feasible method, and you can watch it grow and have a lot of interest and have a lot of questions. And then I personally have been, a lot of my engineering friends have been asking me how it works, and the lifetime of these buildings. And so having that structure being built on a college campus at an intersection of all these paths, that means you are exposing so many people to this really interesting looking style of building, and so many people are learning to appreciate that.
That's certainly the fun of it for me. It's very cool.
I mean, that's because I think it just, in and of itself, all of the issues that you touched on, from the, you know, the societal issues, the economic issues, just all of those things are sources of conversation that are dealt with in the classroom across the divisions and all the different disciplines. And this object seems to be a focus point, or at least a starting point, for a lot of those questions and a lot of those conversations. It is at the intersection of those questions.
Yes.
How do you articulate this philosophy? It seems to be about intimacy and
That's a good question. Yeah, that's a good question. Because for me, it really depends on who you ask. Because it's this, you know, what I describe to you is why I do it. You know, and what I see is its potential. So maybe all I can do is try to articulate my philosophy. And probably you're getting that message because I like building small buildings. You know, so again, that's, you know, I haven't chosen to become a contractor who cranks out, you know, 2,000 square foot building or whatever. You know, small buildings interest me because you can learn as much on a small building as you can on a big one, especially culturally. And no matter what kind of building you make, it's still going to have an impact. So if you're practicing ecological building, you know, big buildings that you need to make. And that's also why I got interested in ecological remodeling. So we have a lot of building, you know, it's like there are places in this country where housing stock is a challenge, but overall we have enough buildings. For the most part, and so, but a lot of them aren't necessarily built well or insulated well, or so I'd say my personal philosophy is just looking for the right use of this tool, given what I see happening in the culture, and the intersection of that with just my personality, which is liking to make small things that I can take forever on if I want to. So, as far as an overall philosophy goes, I'd say most people share an interest in localization. So, you know, using what's local, but also having a local culture. And, of course, there are some impacts in just transport of building materials. And so if you localize, then then that's minimized. And also, if you're using local materials, you might be refining them less, and so that minimizes impact. And then you're designing for your climate. One thing I didn't touch on, but really interests me in natural building, is that the different styles that I showed you are complementary thermally, and so it's possible to make very efficient buildings with natural construction. And so that's a whole yet another realm. To summarize the philosophy, I mean, I'd say more. It's just a really interesting technique coming into our culture at this time. And I don't know that I could. I don't know if I could sum up the philosophy, but maybe that's a summary of my philosophy. And because I see it as this way to open up people to applied ecological design, which I think is really important. Because I mean, building's great, you know, without a context. You know, without an ecological context, the building's only going to get you so far. So.